The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Insulin going through your veins time. Jumping jacks may be in order. So, when we left off, we just finished talking about faculty culture and what a healthy faculty culture is. And the reason why that's so important, because at the end of the day, a healthy faculty culture is your primary driver of enrollment. And in fact, if a healthy culture is cast properly over time, particularly with the creation of those purpose and outcome statements that we talked about, what we have in a healthy faculty culture is the foundation of all of our other marketing elements, all of our other advancement elements. So really, you have to say at the end of the day that all roads lead to faculty in creating that kind of faculty culture that results in a student experience, that results in parents going out into the highways and byways of grocery stores or whatever and talking about your school in a powerful way. What we see in the death spiral of Christian schools around the nation, and I'm sure you're all aware they're closing down like crazy, one of the traits of the death spiral that we see is parents' constituents begin to move from the place where they are strong advocates and cheerleaders to the place where they haven't quite reached the point where they want to leave your school, but they're not bragging a lot about it anymore. You see what I'm saying? And that's when we begin to wonder and worry for you about the danger. So I don't want just parents that are going to attend to my school and stay at my school. I want parents that are having, whose children are having such a transformative experience with my faculty that I can't help but be excited about what's going on with my school. So in a way, really what we're saying is that at the expense of being coy, I hear a lot of people talk about branding out there. Can I just say, branding is not a font. Your students are your brand. I don't want to hear any more about a value narrative. I want to see value. The narrative's nice. We're about to talk about it. But the narrative has to be founded on something that is actually there. And I have a suspicion as to why we struggle with this as Christian schools, because most of us know these things. I doubt that for those of you who've been in the industry, I've told you a whole lot of what you didn't already intuitively know. Maybe I've given you some vocabulary or whatever, but you've always known it. But as we talked about before, it's much easier to tell somebody to fix my website or to do a marketing brochure than it is to sit down across from the dysfunctional faculty member or board member and counsel them out. So it's hard. It requires leadership. And I don't throw that out flippantly. It's all fine until somebody gets an eye put out. You know what I'm saying? It's all fun and games. So we have to take it seriously, our faculty culture. When we do, we've got the middle part of money follows performance when validated. We are performing in the sense of we have made these specific promises to you in the admissions process in the form of a portrait of the graduate. We've told you what our distinctive is, how you can expect to see that impact the education. And now we are going to proceed to validate that over time, over and over again. Because your parents are... I feel like Bueller. Mammals. Your parents are mammals. Monkey doesn't like the shock stick. Okay? So you don't believe me, I think some of you. So here's what we're going to do. I've already got you doing mantras, so I figure we might as well get our total Shirley MacLaine on and do a little bit of channeling here this morning. So here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to put your pens and paper down, and I want you to imagine that you're in a place that's going to be very challenging for you. You are now in a meeting. I know, it's hard. It's hard to imagine. And you are in this meeting, and somebody is going to come, and they are going to slip a piece of paper in front of you that's folded over. So you're there. Do you see that little piece of paper? It's right there in front of you. And what we're going to do in a second is we're going to open up that piece of paper, and we're going to read what it says. And when I do that, this is what I would like you to do. I would like you to yell out the first emotion that comes into your mind and control the profanity, please. Okay? All right. So you ready? We're going to open that. So we're opening it up, and it says, your child's teacher is on the phone. I know what some of you are. So you were very, very cordial and very nice. I've heard all kinds of explanations or whatever you want to call them. But I want you to stop and think about this. We say that our teachers are our partner as a parent in the development of our child. But the reality for the vast majority of schools around the nation is that a call from your teacher instantly solicits a negative response. And that's because normally when we get a call from our teachers, it's about a negative thing. At the very best, we haven't paid the uniform fee on time. But at the very worst, we're calling to talk about what Johnny's done yet again. And so I want you to go back to that circumstance and imagine that with incredible precision, you've weaseled your way out of that meeting. I applaud you for that. And now you're on the phone and you're picking up the phone. And this is what the teacher says to you. They say, Mr. or Mrs. Johnson, something happened with Susie today, and I really felt like you should know about it. At this point, if you have heart medication, you are now taking that. So what happened was the kids, the small kids were playing and the big kids were playing basketball. Susie was playing with them. And one of the small children fell and skinned their knee. And before our teacher's assistants could even get there, Susie had stopped playing basketball with the big kids. She'd run over and she had lifted up that child and was comforting them. And I want you to know, Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, that when we saw that, we saw Susie modeling for us exactly what we're talking about when we say we want the graduates of Trinity Academy to use their strength to lift those who are weak up and not to push them down. And she just personified that for us. And we want you to know, we want to thank you for what you guys are doing at home to partner with us in educating your child. So we used to get questions about, should we leave that kind of thing on an answering machine? So we said, well, yeah. And so then we got feedback from parents, because we do like 20,000 parent surveys a year or whatever. And they started talking about this. And we have more than one where a family talks about literally gathering around the answering machine and hitting the button over and over again. You don't have enrollment because you keep shocking the monkey. Monkey don't like to be shocked. Monkey needs to know that you own their child, not just their boo-boos and their mistakes and what they've done wrong today, but their hopes and their dreams and their aspirations and the good in them, that you own all of that and that you see it. And so a very simple thing that we have to begin to do, part of any parent relations program, is we have to begin to train our faculty, first of all, to do what we call proactive communications. So the first thing is I need to start systematically looking for the good that children do. So I want to tell you, I'm going to get off on a little tangent, so forgive me, and you can all write mean evals. I don't blame you. But I have a growing concern as a Christian educator, and I know you're going to not like what I'm about to say, but I got to tell you, I go around the nation, and I see a group of adults that really don't trust children. They are struggling with seeing the good in children. Now, when I say that, they immediately go, oh, no, no! How can you say that? And they really feel that in their heart. But I'm just talking about the way they interact with children day in and day out. Their hands are crossed. They got their glasses down. They're waiting for the bad stuff to come. Because after all, foolishness is in the heart of a child, and it is my personal responsibility to get it out of them. And in this sense, the world has us beat, because though the world doesn't give the complete picture, the world says, look, there's some good in children. We need to look for the good. We need to encourage them. We need to see their hopes, their dreams, their aspirations. God created them for a purpose. That's what we say. God gave them talents and skills for a purpose. That's what we preach. So we've got to, as a community of teachers, begin to reevaluate and reflect with our Maker about the attitude that we are getting towards students. You know, when I talk about faculty, one of the things I don't mention is this concept talked about in some of the early research in the 80s done on faculty. They talked about a content culture. And I know this would never happen in your schools, but in other schools, particularly in high school faculties, what we ultimately have is a content-focused culture. We have teachers that are mathematicians first, and oh yeah, I've got students. I should have finished that PhD. What you need is you need people who are committed and love and engaged and excited and see the good in children. Oh, and I love mathematics too. I want to see children thrive and their lives transformed. Oh, I love biology. You see, that's the order that we need when we hire people. Because if I get that order reversed, it's all fine and good as long as I'm an A student. But woe to anybody else that isn't. And I think you have to minister to more than just your A students. So, we have got to change that cycle. And it's particularly true because people are coming to us with a contract mentality anyway. Most parents, even Christian parents, are coming to see what they can get out of it. Are you right for my kid? What, you know, is this place going to be okay for my kid? And this is the world in which parents today are used to living. They do everything contractually, right? It's a business proposition. Your schools are being shopped. Does everybody know what I mean by shopped? Right, your schools are being shopped more than they ever have. 30 years ago, it wasn't that way. 30 years ago, private independent Christian schools were viewed more as like a church. They weren't like your other business transactions. That is not the way it is now. And people are used to wheeling and dealing and bargaining and carrying a host of negative behaviors into that. So the first thing you have to do is you have to acknowledge it. You can't put your head in the sand. That's of no use to you. You've got to acknowledge that parents are coming to you with a contract mentality. So last time I checked, a contract was about something between two people, right? So the first thing is, I don't let the contract be a one-sided conversation. The schools that really improve enrollment demand talk as much about what their expectations are as let the parents talk about what their expectations are. And this is very counterintuitive to young admissions officers that freak out when I talk about this. That would be another technical term. Because they want to say yes to everything, and saying yes to everything is the worst possible thing you could possibly do. You want to be very open and cordial and engaging. You want to invite them into your community, but you want to be very clear about what that community is and what it isn't, and what it means to be part of that community. You want to begin the conversation of the parent-school contract. And I don't mean the enrollment contract. I mean the commitment that we are making together on behalf of your child. And the better schools even begin to spell that out. And they spell that out in the language of predictability and supportiveness. This is not, you know, Sister Susan with a ruler out. This is, hey, we have both agreed that we want to create these outcomes in the life of your child. As a result, we're going to, as a faculty and staff, try to do these things. And boy, we really need you as parents to come along and create these things and do these things. It's not about you do this. It's about we're doing this together. And that's not just fancy talk or nuanced talk. That's the way it should be. And so the first thing we want to do is we want to own the contract, but we cannot leave them there. And so within the first year or two, I want to move my parents from this contract mentality when it's focused on themselves, and I want to get them to see that my school represents a potential philanthropic enterprise that is beyond just their personal experience with my child. And I'm going to demonstrate to that to them, and I'm going to start with my engagement with their child and show that I am a good place to give your charitable dollars. That I am worth the amount of tuition that you are paying. That yes, we are going to have a 4% tuition increase next year. And yes, you are going to pay it and you are going to want to stay because you wouldn't dream of leaving this school. And that 4% tuition increase is necessary to create the things that we have both agreed upon. And here they are. This isn't really a tuition increase. This is an expansion of our vision and dream and the transformation of children. And oh, by the way, it costs money. And this is the way we need to begin to look at it. So what we want to do is we want to draw parents into a community relationship. There's a phrase we use at ISM. It's a cute little phrase, but it sort of typifies what we're talking about. We want to move them from the idea that this school is good for my child to the idea that this school is good for children. Do you see that? Do you see that? That small, subtle change is all the difference in the world. That subtle change means now I want to give to the annual fund. That subtle change means now I might be interested in helping you with a capital project. That subtle change means, and this happens all around the nation, I've seen it. I've seen it in classical schools. This is the sweetness right here when you've got parent volunteers that actually stay after their children leave. So can I tell you right now, if you're working on boards, that is the sweet spot. The best possible board member is a past parent. All of the mission and passion, none of the drama. Oh, yeah, babe. Loving that. Bring it on. And we need to begin to seriously think about that. We are beginning to cultivate. We want to become a philanthropic enterprise. And so this is really what we're talking about when we're talking about parents. We're talking about moving them into engagement with us that's meaningful and actually putting legs and feet to this thing called a partnership. So at ISM, we talk about all of these things in terms of your PREP. So here's a good word, your PREP, your Parent Retention and Education Program. So notice that the first piece in driving enrollment is retaining the people I have, right? Because we all know when I lose somebody that I'm not just having to replace their seat, but if I want to go to get ahead, I got to replace two seats now. And if I'm losing a lot of people and there are reasons why, I got to attend to that. And so we want to create a PREP. This is the systematic approach that we have as an organization, and it goes all the way up, quite frankly, into the boardroom and the way board members engage with parents, all the way down into the way our parent associations work and a host of things. So as I said before, there's just no way I can communicate to you a week's worth of instruction in 50 minutes. What I can do is introduce you to the topic and send some more reading your way. This is a lifetime journey. But here are some of the things that we want to see about your PREP. So the first thing I want you to see is it does involve being proactive. If I hear, here we go, rant number three. If I hear another Christian school administrator, any school administrator, but Christian schools in particular, if I hear another form of this, well, she's a little prickly with parents, but she's so good in the classroom. Other than that, Mrs. Kennedy, what did you think of Texas? I can't have you if you can't relate to parents, and I don't care how good you are in the classroom, because part of teacherness is being able to engage parents effectively. That does not mean giving them everything they want. That does not mean always saying yes. In fact, good parent relations means being very adept at saying no at times. But it does mean that I'm in the mosh pit, all these technical terms I keep throwing out, with those parents. And I'm engaged with those parents. And I'm educating those parents about the things that I'm doing with their children. And I'm demonstrating to those parents that I know their child, their hopes, their dreams, their aspirations. And so the first thing we have to do is we have to realize that I, from this point on, don't hire anybody who is not adept at parent relations and or, if they're new to the field, is not willing to learn parent relations. The second thing, in a practical sense, is that I understand that the core part of my new teacher induction programs, whether they are new to the field or new to my school, is parent relations. You know, having worked with a lot of induction programs, here's a great fallacy. It's incredible. The two things that new teachers need the most, classroom management skills, I'm sorry, creating a learning environment. I'm getting my language right. That's right. We called it classroom management when I was there. And parent relations. Those two things are the things that they are least prepared by their schools of education to engage with effectively. They are the two things that are most necessary for them to succeed at right away, right? And they are the things that we talk the least about in most induction programs. Go figure. So when you begin to hire, when you begin to recruit, when you begin to train, when you begin to integrate professional development, when you do peer exercises, a huge piece of it has to be about how can we engage more effectively with parents? How can I create a positive dialogue with parents? How can I create a well of good feeling with parents so that when the hard conversations do come, and they will, that parent is willing to hear me? Because I'm not some stranger trying to speak into their child's life. I'm not the hired help. I am an active participant and partner in the life of their child. Now they have the ears to hear, perhaps. So the second thing is, I've got to, as a school, begin to systematically validate my programs. And this is another area that can be misunderstood. So when Johnny gets in the car from carpool and he gets back in the back seat and you ask him how his day went, what does Johnny say? Fine. Can I have my iPad? That's another subject for another day. So here's the reality. Even when it's going well, we cannot just leave it up to our kids to spontaneously validate our program. We need to reinforce on a regular basis that what they have said that they wanted and what we said we would deliver and what we have all agreed upon is actually happening. And I need to go in an ongoing process through my website, through my events, through a host of different things. I need to be able to constantly be communicating the message. Here's what we said we would do. Here's what we're doing. Look how it's transforming lives. Here's what we said we would do. Here's what we're doing. Look how it's transforming lives. That happens on the tactical level with you and your teachers in engagement with your students. When the board is doing its thing, it happens on the strategic level with the strategic plan. We said we would do these things in our strategic plan that we marketed to you. Look, we've checked another one off. Look, we built that playground. We did that building. We changed that curriculum. We did that. We're succeeding. This is what we need to understand. People want to be with a winner. They want to be with a winner. They want to be with a place that's going places. They don't want to be with a place that can't figure out their finances and can't charge what it costs and, oh, woe is me, and gee, can you help us out, and gosh golly gee, Eeyore, Eeyore, Eeyore. They want to see that you as leaders are getting things done and that you're moving this program forward. And by the way, I see nothing inconsistent with the Christian worldview and that. I see nothing that tells me that Christ told me to be a big loser. Okay? Just don't see it. Now, Christ taught me I have to learn to deal with loss. That's a different story. So, it's very, very important that we get this psychological thing going on with our parents, both on the macro level and the micro level. We said we'd do it. We're doing it. Look at what it looks like. Let's celebrate it. And we need to come from a variety of different venues, because some of your parents and some of your kids are going to be the website people. And some of the people are going to be the people that come to the events. And some of the people are going to be the other people, you know, that do your pulse emails. But whatever it is, however it happens, on a regular basis, both on the classroom level as a teacher, communicating proactively with my parents, and systemically as an organization, we want to be in a nonstop flow of positive reinforcement about what? It's not, remember our conversation about the phone call. Did I just say that your child done good? Do you remember? Did I say that but I said something more than that they done good, right? Does anybody remember? I said, what? They completed the mission. I didn't just say they did good. I attached it to one of our portraits of the graduate. Do you see? That is a big deal. It's not enough to say you've done good. You want to take the done good moment and use it to further educate your parents about what you're doing in the lives of children. Remember, I'm personifying my mission. My students are my brand. I'm not just validating in general. I'm validating with specificity. Here are the things that we are doing, and I'm doing it in a multitude of ways. One of the underutilized ways is my volunteer program. So here's what I would say to you. You know, and I don't know where you're at, but I would completely rethink my volunteer program. in this sense. That yes, it's great that I have a bunch of people doing things for free that help subsidize my budget. That's great. But that is by far the secondary reason for my volunteer program. By far. The number one reason I have a volunteer program is to create experiences where my parents can get in the beanbag chair. You know what I'm saying? Because the beanbag chair is powerful. It's powerful. All those little critters running around with bright eyes and dreams and the hope of tomorrow. And you're there in the middle of it. That's the power. I need to find the intersection point of my parent body and their interests with the things that we are trying to do in the lives of our children. And I need to create experiences through my volunteer program where they experience the mission directly. Oh, yeah, and I get some stuff done for free. That's great. But what I get is I get people that have a heightened level of engagement. Listen, getting stuff done for free is great. But I want the big check for my capital campaign. And that's not because I'm selfish or greedy or materialistic. It's because I'm going to take that money and I'm going to use it for something good. I'm going to, as Dallas Willard says, I'm going to kingdom sanitize that money. I'm going to turn it into transform lives. So money's beautiful. I want lots of it. I want all of it I can get because I'm going to transform lives with that money. So, the volunteer program is a big deal. We need to look for creative ways. So, for instance, you know, my parent that's a cardiac surgeon, a famous cardiac surgeon, she's probably not going to have time to stuff, admissions packets for me. But if I called her one day and I said, you know, we're doing a section on the cardiovascular system. And I know you're busy. I really know you're busy. But here's the thing. I really thought it would be awesome at some point during this next semester if we could get you in just for a short section just to talk about your experience and what you see in the cardiovascular system and to bring real relevance, to get it outside of just we're talking about biology and to get a real doctor who's really engaged. Would you be willing to do that? Let me tell you something. When you find that intersection between their talents and mission and yours, you will find that doctor freeing up her schedule with amazing speed. And she will be there, and she will teach a class like you've never seen. And she will walk away going, wow, this place is good for children. So parent relations is huge, and it is a necessary part of being a faculty member. So as an administrator, you want to get this cycle here. I invite them into my school. I bring them in realizing that they have a contract mentality. I immediately connect them in such a way with my school that I am validating and transforming and just pretty soon, very quickly in that, they become like little missionaries for me, going out on the highways and byways. And they start spreading the word. And then they come back and they re-enroll, but they're spinning more people in over and over again. And that is how private schools drive enrollment. And unless you have planted yourself in a cornfield or in some rural urban blight, which is a different question for the church movement, because those people need schools too, and those people probably will need some form of soft money. And we better solve that as a movement, as a church, and not just expect individuals to solve it, in my opinion. But for the vast majority of people, if I have five administrators call and complain about enrollment demand, I can guarantee you that four of them, the monster is not out there. The monster is in the mirror. And you have to confront yourself and your practices and move them forward. This also means something else. This means that I cannot lay it all at the feet of my admissions director to drive enrollment. To which now all the admissions directors stand up and do a wave like, we love Bill Simmer, he's great, we love him. Here's the thing. I need a good admissions officer. I want them to be very professional. I'm going to hold them accountable. But they are a catalyst for the energy. They can organize the energy. They can direct the energy. But they cannot create the energy. Which means I need academic leaders that can. And I need academic leaders that can get with my admissions officer and plan like adults and face the reality that we have to drive enrollment and that that is not the language of compromise, but that they need to come down from their idealistic, lofty perch and they need to work with admissions people on how they are going to drive enrollment. Make no mistake about it, it is the responsibility of my division heads to help me drive enrollment. And if I have a division head that can't do that, then they're not going to be much help to me. I know this doesn't happen at your school, but at other schools I've been to, there's some stinking thinking about money. And faculty can, theoretically, approach it as if I'm the idealistic classical educator. I'm too busy reading Aristotle to deal with that filthy lucre. That's for you advancement people to deal with. Oh, I can't stand it when she floats around the room. Yes, I am pure and above that, unless my paycheck's late, in which case I'm in a tantrum. Money's beautiful. They're all in it together. They're all responsible for enrollment. You need to, as a leader, get rid of that kind of silly talk if it exists in your school. Christ and the Bible talks more about money than about any other subject. And Christ constantly connects the use and attitude of money to our spiritual life. Think about that. Constantly connects the use and attitude we have towards money with our spiritual life. Last time I checked, where your treasure is? Yes. The world, so I'm sorry if I'm getting a little preachy here, but I've been doing this for 13 years, and can I just have a completely transparent moment with you? My heart is weary and sad. Because there's so many dragons that should have been slayed in those 13 years, and we are so stiff-necked and stubborn. And we are going to lose our movement if we don't get serious about it. So there you go. How's that for encouragement? But it's easily resolved. And that is that we understand that the resources are there, that God calls us to excellence, that we know very clearly the things that work because they've worked for decades. And while there are always going to be idiosyncrasies and specific applications of those and your specific challenges, that it is well within our ability to grow our schools. So how much time do we have here? Let's see. We go till what? 1:50? So what I'd like to do, which I didn't think I would have the time to do, but I'm going to take it, is I'd like to open it up for questions. So here's the deal. You have to speak loudly, not just so that I can hear you, but so that all your fellow participants can hear you. So, jump in. Questions? Yes. So definitely email me and let me give you some articles. One of the skills of leadership, and it's a great question you have, because it's a skill you need to begin to develop now, and it's what's called leading up. And trust me, when you become a head of school, you better learn how to do it because you got this thing called a board. And you're going to have to lead up with that board. Okay? So leading up, one of the things you do is you learn how to systematically needle your boss without getting them angry at you. Or feeling like you're rebellious. And that's a talent. You got to work through that slowly. And so what you do is you begin to feed them information. Say, man, I've been reading this really interesting stuff. What do you think about this? You don't get too preachy. So I'm going to say something you're not going to like. And some of you are going to be angry. But it's just my experience. in a Christian community as a woman, you got a double whammy against you. Because if you are seen as an uppity, you know what I'm saying? So just you want to do it in a way that's nuanced and doesn't get their defenses up and gets them to hear you. And you just slowly but surely begin to educate them. And you find allies, not in some subversive way, not in a way to undermine the leadership of the head, but in a benevolent way, you begin to find fellow teachers that begin to feel, and then you begin to talk about things, and then you begin to go to your head and you say, you know, for my professional development growth experience, you know, I was working with some of my other faculty members, and we thought it would be really, really cool to start a new teacher induction program and begin to help train new teachers more effectively on these skills, to which your head will probably go, thank goodness, that's one less thing I have to do. Does that help? That's what has to happen. Little by little, educate. Don't alienate. Yes. I was waiting for one. Right. Look, hear, hear. Hear, hear. Did you hear what he said? He said, me and my son-in-law are from that cornfield you mentioned, and it works there too. And I want to say this, thank you for that, because that's my lack of faith. And I want to tell you that it does. Even if it doesn't give you full enrollment, it makes things better. There's nothing we've talked about here today that's going to make your school worse. Okay, you know what I'm saying? It's only going to make your school better. But absolutely, thank you for that, and thank you for your ministry. And I mean that very sincerely. Thank you. Yes. Did you hear that? Leaders love it when you can take something off their plate because there is no job like a head of school. Heads of school basically are asked to do the impossible job. And I could teach a workshop on that right now. And particularly with the increased litigation, need for human resource knowledge, facilities knowledge, fundraising, business compliance, you know, all the things you went to school for that you love so much and that you're drawn to and that you want to spend evenings reading about, right? That's just what got you into Christian education. But it has to be understood. So the head definitely needs, and here's a beautiful thing now that you mention it about this kind of culture that I didn't mention. The healthier your culture gets, the more you can do what we call push leadership down. So here's something that heads of school don't want to tell some of their faculties. They're afraid to give some of the stuff away because they just don't feel it'll get done well. And they're probably right. But when the culture is strong and vibrant and growing, then a ton of stuff can get pushed down, and not in some way to labor, you know, not to you know, make life miserable, not to overwork people. I don't mean it in that way, but to say, look, let's have distributed leadership. You know, yes, I'm the person ultimately responsible, but you step up and you show leadership and you have a piece of the puzzle and you write your bit on the tapestry of what's going on in the lives of our children at this school. And so thank you for that, because that ultimately is what I need to do. And that's what has to happen for my school to reach the maturity level. For it to get to real maturity, it has to happen, because the head simply cannot do it all, even if you're fully staffed. Thank you. Other thoughts? Oh, wow. I have really done you a disservice, haven't I? Yes. 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 That's fantastic. Oh, well, listen, thank you. You all heard what she said. It's very important. As one thing that classical schools that I've worked with suffer from as a general, not you, but other schools, And you share this with your Montessori peeps. And you're like, how in the world are we similar to Montessori? But there's actually an incredible amount of parallels we could talk about. But one of the things is you have your own jargon. And it's your best friend and your worst enemy. And so when it comes to communicating with parents that have no idea what the classical movement is, you've got to get off your jargon, at least until you've had a chance to get them in and educate them. And you've got to colloquialize some of these concepts. And here's the thing about it. I have to say to you, as a classical educator, I'll give you an example. The term rigorous education, so you guys are going to, I'm going about to be tarred and feathered. But I find that to be a very negative statement anymore. I think rigor, I know what we mean by it, but what the result is a bunch of kids sitting in rows, bored out of their gourd. That's another technical term. And completely irrelevant from their lives in some institutions. And so I don't want something akin to a corpse. That's not what I'm trying to educate for. I want a dynamic, transformational experience for my children. I want children that are going to be culture changers, that are going to be nation changers, that are going to be world changers. I do not want to see, again, like the book of Judges, that a day came when they did not know the word of the Lord anymore, that God was not there. I want to see a generation on fire. You know, when we look at the surveys from Christian schools, and it's not just myself, it's a bunch of other Christian organizations, we're beginning to see a picture, and here's what it looks like. The majority of students from Christian schools say this when surveyed and given the opportunity to speak candidly. They say, if that's what Christianity is, we don't want any part of it. And we know that we are under the power of these adults right now, so we got to play the game. But we are so out of here the minute that we have our own lives. And we see it. It happens all across the nation. The other groups say, okay, I adopt the Christian life, but what I get out of it is something that Christ taught so very vehemently against, and that is I begin to segregate and ghettoize myself as a Christian, and now I'm over here, and 5 years later, I don't have a single significant unsaved friend in my life. That's what we got. I'm telling you that there's a small group in the middle that we're transforming still. But when don't get mad at me, talk to the kids, get mad at them. They're saying you're either irrelevant, I don't want anything to do with you, or I'm joining the Pharisee class. Woo! We have got to create the middle. We have got to create people who are engaged and who have a dynamic relationship with Christ, but at the same time that they can be critical of the culture and see where the culture is going, they love the culture. They love the people in it. They want to see it turn for Christ. And I don't know about you, but I cannot read the Gospels and come away with any other conclusion that is what Christ has called me to. Thank you. I wish I'd have thought that one up myself. But seriously, it's dynamic. So I hope that this has helped. And I apologize for my diatribe. And we'll talk more about serious stuff tomorrow if you want to talk about money. But we can do this, guys. Get out of Eeyore land. Your father owns a cattle on 1,000 hills. If we improve our practice, we know how we can do this, and we can revolutionize our nation, perhaps one last time. I don't know. Anyway, I want to thank you so much for your time, and I hope I've been a blessing. Thank you.